Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Alonso Nunez of sunny San Diego, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, and thank you to Alonso Nunez in San Diego that you heard there introducing the show. David's here. Hello, David.
Hello. How are we doing?
We're doing good. Thank you, David. How are you doing, more to the point?
Very good. I've just enjoyed watching Andy Murray win from a match point down again, which I was thinking when it was happening is exactly the thing that hasn't happened for the last 2 years. And I'm quite sure I thought that about 2 or 3 weeks ago as well, when it was against Berrettini. So I quite enjoyed all that.
Well, you're now making me question my hypothesis, which was that Matt, hello, Matt, did the
hello.
Tweet that just came out on our Tennis Podcast feed about Andy Murray beating Italians from match point down. He's shaking his head. Was it you, David? You did a stat.
Yes, it was. It's a 2-point stat.
doing that twice in 2023, when we're only a few weeks into 2023, is stat worthy, I think.
It is. It is epics only for Andy Murray in 2023, I think. I mean, I don't know how David has done that, because we have been on a video call with David since that match ended, and I haven't seen him do anything that might resemble tweeting. He's stealth, that man.
Mm. Very strange, because I do not think of you, David, as one of the world's great multitaskers. You've got a lot of skills. I wouldn't put multitasking up there.
No, I think that's fair. Apart from when I stopped us getting hacked mid-podcast
yes.
once in one of our social media accounts. But on this particular occasion, you may have noticed that I didn't actually start the conversation until the very second that Andy Murray had won, giving me just enough time to tweet the news.
We were in the waiting room while you were waiting for that.
Yes. Yeah, we were. Not as glamorous a place as it sounds, folks, the StreamYard waiting room. Anyway, tennis has been happening. We're going to talk about all of it on this pod. That is brought to you with On Location, the premium hospitality and experience provider. There are only 2 weeks to go until they bring us, the Tennis Podcast, all three of us, to the BNP Paribas Open in Indian Wells for the first time as a crew. And I use crew there in the sort of film and TV industry sense, not in any way cool group of people sense. But maybe we'll become cool in the California desert. Who knows? On Location owns Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours, which has been organising amazing holidays, vacations to our American friends, to the biggest tennis tournaments for decades. The link to check out what they have to offer is in our show notes and in our newsletter, which will go out this week. On Location are offering a 5% discount code to all friends of the Tennis Podcast on all Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours throughout 2023. So if you would like to attempt to be a cool crew as well, then become a friend and check out the discount code. You've got one more week to take advantage of that offer. And David has booked his golf clubs onto the plane. That's our big Indian Wells news week.
I've never done it before. I've never gone anywhere with golf clubs before. So I did have to look up how you do it. I think I've made it work. So yeah, let's see if they actually turn up at the appointed time. I've been looking at, I asked Catherine to see if she could help me find some golf courses, and she did a 4-second check and discovered we were surrounded by 6 golf courses. So I think we're all right.
Yeah, there's more golf course than there is anything else in Indian Wells. I mean, you can't move for golf courses, so I think that you'll be fine. Now, in terms of tennis happening, well, literally right now, actually, I've just put the stream of Elena Rybakina against Bianca Andreescu onto my TV, which quite ludicrously is a first round match in Dubai. Absolutely ridiculous, but brilliant. Rybakina has taken the opening set there, 6-3. Let's talk about what happened last week, though. Starting in Doha, the WTA 500 event there won by Iga Świątek for the second consecutive year for the loss of just, wait for it, folks, this is an accurate stat. I know you're going to hear me say it and you're going to think, that can't be right. She lost 5 games all tournament, and she played really good opposition. A bye in the first round. Okay, that's not great opposition. Let's do away with byes. Second round, 6-love, 6-1 over Danielle Collins, who beat her in the Australian Open semi-finals last year. Quarterfinal, okay, a walkover against Belinda Bencic. I had reported on the podcast last week that Belinda Bencic wasn't playing Doha, having won the week before, probably shouldn't have played Doha. Anyway, semi-final, 6-love, 6-1 against Veronika Kudermetova. I'll say that again, 6-love, 6-1 against the very good tennis player Veronika Kudermetova. And the final, 6-3, 6-love against Jessica Pegula, who did go on to win the doubles title alongside Coco Gauff, which means that the singles and doubles champions in 2023 are exactly the same as in 2022. And I think this is quite a significant win for Iga Świątek, because Doha was where the streak started last year. This is where she is starting to defend her position as the dominant player in the world. This kind of marks the year anniversary of her becoming that. We didn't characterize it as that exactly at the time, because, you know, we didn't have the benefit of hindsight. But we know now that this week last year was the start of something huge for Iga Świątek and for tennis. And I'm not saying that she's going to go on the same streak again and defend all those titles. Look, she might. But I think starting off that defence in this way, given what she told us about her state of mind in Australia, I think is really big for her.
I do too. And actually, it does remind me that she was pretty serene and phlegmatic about things in that press conference after the defeat she had in Australia. She didn't seem to think it was going to be a massive problem going forwards, but at the same time, it was a problem in the moment. It was a problem at this tournament, but she was able to sort of sort it out. And the next one that she played is what she expected to be able to do. I mean, and boy, did she. I mean, this was extraordinary, this level of form. And it was just a reminder that when she plays well, when she's at the top of her game, she is the best. And I mean, I guess Aryna Sabalenka may have an argument to say, well, hold on, what about me? I played my best and won the Australian Open. But nobody beats people for the loss of one game repeatedly when they're top players. That isn't a fluke, what she has just pulled off. She had a bye. Yes, she had a walkover due to an injury, but she's beaten 3 world-class players and just kind of humiliated them. And it was a simultaneously a bit awkward, but also, if you're a fan of just majestic brilliance, it was a joyful experience as well.
I bet Danielle Collins was relieved to see the scoreline of Świątek against Veronika Kudermetova and similarly yeah. against Jessica Pegula in the final, because at the time when, you know, that was Świątek's first match at the tournament, wasn't it? Having had the bye in the first round, you thought it looked, I mean, obviously brilliant for Świątek, but yeah, embarrassing for Danielle Collins. But it turns out she was just, you know, that was just par for Świątek last week.
Whereas Belinda Bencic knew, she just took one look at Świątek and thought, I am out of here. I'm not having any of this. And yeah, I mean, to be fair, I was actually looking forward to that match because I'd watched Bencic come back from a set and a break down against Azarenka. And it was one of those really gritty wins that we talked about her having a lot the previous week. And I thought, right, I want to see this Bencic against that Świątek that we saw in her first match. And I think that would have been interesting, but yeah, we obviously didn't get to see it. Absolutely agree with everything you said about Iga Świątek and the importance of this win coming back from Australia. I had a look at some historical context for her run this week and only losing five games. And, you know, I thought, is that a record? And I sort of set out to try and find out whether it was. And without access to a proper sort of database that the WTA have or the ITF have, it's really hard to find that out. You literally have to go through draws. And I was thinking, right, I'm gonna start with players like Monica Seles and Steffi Graf and Chris Evert, because they used to literally just trounce people all the time. Anyway, while I was doing all that, WTA notes popped up in my email, and they had it there and there for me. They had done the work to confirm that this was the fewest games ever lost en route to a WTA title. I think the important thing to note is what we said, only three matches. Now, there are two examples of players only losing seven games. One of them was Conchita Martinez, only lost seven games in four matches when she won in Hamburg in 1995. What I like about this is that five of the seven games that she lost were in the first round. And then from then on, she won 6-1, 6-love in the quarters, double bagel in the semis, and then beat a 14-year-old Martina Hingis in her first WTA final, 6-1, 6-love in the final.
Oh my God.
And then I think probably the most impressive is Chris Evert only losing seven games in five matches when she won in Lugano in 1981. There were two double bagels in that run. So, yeah, she's in that kind of company, Iga Świątek, with this win in Doha. She's just head and shoulders above everyone else, it seems, when she plays like this. And especially, I think, in these conditions, like I think slower courts generally. And also, it was really windy, certainly in the last couple of rounds. And with her spin and her control on the ball, it just seems like she can still do what she wants in those conditions, whereas other players are really having to adjust and make changes, and it just disrupts them. But she can cope with it.
It is such a low-key power tool, isn't it? Being able to play in the wind. I always think of Andy Murray having that skill, and obviously Nadal probably the best wind player of all time on the men's side. It's, you know, it's not a sexy tool, but it is it when you need it, you really need it.
And in her case, she was having a huge disparity in the final between when it was behind her and when it was into the headwind, and she seemed to be relishing that difference. Whereas you'd got Pegula, who, when she got the win behind her, you're like, her balls are just flying off the strings, and she was clearly having to try to keep it within in order to use the wind but not overhit. Whereas Świątek looked like she almost had a setting in her racket that she was flicking between the two sides of the court, and one plays with the wind, one plays against it, and she looked like she couldn't miss. It's just amazing.
I have such respect for players that can play well in the wind. And I speak as someone who cancelled, sort of, a game of tennis last week because blustery conditions were on the forecast. I was supposed to be playing with your brother, Catherine, and we sort of agreed between us that, nah, it's not going to be any fun in those conditions. Let's save it for a better day. And I know that is pathetic of us, probably, and people are probably eye-rolling as they listen to this. But, you know, I hate playing in the wind so much. And, yeah. That's one of many reasons why I'm not a pro tennis player, I suppose.
Well, you and Novak Djokovic both, he doesn't like it much either. I mean, he does
That's
tend
true.
To
I am
know,
in
not, not pull out when he sees a bad weather forecast, but he doesn't love it. Just quickly casting our minds back to United Cup for a second and the beautiful sun of Australia, how long ago that feels. And Jessica Pegula beating Iga Świątek. Remembering that match, remembering what we had to say about it afterwards, analysis-wise, we weren't heralding it as her necessarily turning that match up on its head, were we? She did that by just hitting a massive purple patch, as I recall, and being able to sustain it, crucially. So is it no great surprise that she's not still getting close to peak Iga Świątek or peak-ish Iga Świątek? Or do we think that was most likely an anomaly, that result?
Like, I think we definitely credited the conditions at the time and they felt big. And there were three big factors in particular. One, it was indoors. Two, it was extremely quick. And three, Świątek had to travel from a different location to go, I think, to Sydney, wasn't it, where that match was played. And the conditions were a little bit different. Pegula had been in Sydney the whole time, had sort of adapted to them. So I definitely think there were a lot of factors for why Pegula won that compared to her previous matches against Świątek. And this does feel like a more of a reversion to what we're used to seeing in that matchup. I guess in this instance the conditions were much more in Iga Świątek's favor. Like I thought the scoreline would be closer than 6-3, 6-love. I felt like if anyone could get a little bit closer to Świątek, it would be Pegula, especially with what Pegula did to Świątek's serve in the United Cup. She just absolutely dominated it. And you know, that's before the rallies have started. I felt like maybe that would still be sustainable, but Iga Świątek did point out that she'd really been working on her serve in the last 3 weeks. She said her serve on court and her sort of mental approach off court has been what she's been focusing on. And yeah, she's maybe just tightened that up. But yeah, I guess I would expect to see some slightly tighter score lines than 6-3, 6-love going forward between these two. But I definitely think, you know, when they're both playing well, Świątek is going to be the one winning that matchup most of the time.
Speaking of reversions to things we're used to seeing, Bianca Andreescu medical timeout currently happening on my screen.
Don't need that.
Yeah, and on a different body part to the last time I saw her receiving a medical timeout was in Hua Hin in the semi-final there, where she ended up retiring. Or was it? No, it was the semi-final, wasn't it? Ended up retiring. And it was, I can't remember what body part it was, but it was a different body part to this one. It's not going well for Andreescu at the moment.
Was it shoulder neck area in Hua Hin, I think.
Oh, well, this is her shoulder / neck that she's having, I feel like, massaged. Okay. Is not an accurate depiction of what I'm seeing. Manhandled, womanhandled. Anyway, doesn't look
our idea of a massage is different to different. Tennis players on court, isn't it? we've got the idea of a sort of spa treatment, haven't we, when you talk about massage.
Let's head to Rotterdam, shall we now, and the ATP 500 event that was happening there this week. Daniil Medvedev winning it 5-7, 6-2, 6-2 in the final over Jannik Sinner, who was brilliant in that first set, wasn't he, Sinner? Pretty much a perfect set from Jannik Sinner, and so perfect it felt a little bit unsustainable at the time, didn't it? And there was that, I don't know, you saw the experience of Daniil Medvedev, didn't you? I felt like I saw inside his mind where he was going, okay, keep it up, kid. Keep it up. I'll be here. And he was there, and he showed some real resilience, which is what I've been longing to see from Daniil Medvedev. I know it's indoors. I know it's best of three sets. I know it's not Novak Djokovic as opposition, but, you know, baby steps for Medvedev. This is significant, I think.
Yeah, I thought it was significant because that, and actually I think all three sets were significant in as much as Jannik Sinner showed a top level that I think maybe is higher than I've seen before, in terms of he took it to Medvedev and he dealt with Medvedev's base game. And he was a better player in that first set. He was more powerful. He was more assertive. He wasn't just being reactive. I feel like I'm seeing an impact of a coach in the way he's going about his business, going to the net a lot more. He's got Darren Cahill as his coach, who is somebody who played that way, went to the net a lot. And that doesn't necessarily mean you coach a player that way, but I think he sees that that is an element of the game that Sinner could improve upon. But just generally, he wasn't just being reactive. He was taking it to Medvedev. And although Sinner's always hit the ball hard, I think that there's more purpose about how he's hitting it hard now. And that I think he was understanding in his mind, I'm not going to outlast this guy, so I'm going to have to take it from him. So at the end of that first set, I really think Sinner is going to win the match. And look, he lost the next two sets comfortably, 6-2, 6-2. I felt like the second set, Medvedev stood up to him, really refused to rely on the base game and wait for Sinner to come back to him. He took it from him. And then I feel like maybe that shocked Sinner a bit. And fatigue perhaps played a part, because that's 2 weeks in a row that he's gone all the way. But I thought they were both really impressive in their own respective ways. And, you know, you might say that Sinner losing from a setup without winning many games is a bit of a concern, but I'd say it's more that Medvedev took it from him and Sinner ran a little bit out of gas. I don't know what you two think.
Yeah, I was really impressed with Jannik Sinner this week. I think it was big for him to get a win over Tsitsipas, as he did. I think it was quite early on in the tournament, wasn't it, that those two met. And he's just starting to have a bit more success now against Tsitsipas. Like I know he lost their match at the Australian Open, but it was really, really close. And here he was like flawless in that match. And, you know, those two could be rivals for a few years. So I think it's important that he's sort of started to turn that head-to-head round a little bit. And then he kept up that level, certainly in the first set against Medvedev, as you said, David. I just feel like for Sinner, he really needs to win one of these matches against one of the absolute top players when he's playing well. You know, two sets up on Djokovic at Wimbledon last year, that incredible match against Alcaraz at the US Open, leading Medvedev by a set in the final. Like, there've been some instances where he's shown how well he can play. He's just not necessarily finishing it off. But, you know, I think the level is there. And then as for Medvedev, well, I just think I was trying to figure out how different this was to Vienna last year, which was when I thought Medvedev was back, because he won that title at end of the season and he played well. And I think what makes this one different is the resilience that you said. Like I know he came back from a set down in the final in Vienna last year against Shapovalov, but all due respect, that's Shapovalov. Like he can just play a good set. And yeah, exactly. Like I don't think he necessarily needed to really dig in as hard against Shapovalov as he had to against Sinner. And he only came back from a set down to win twice in the whole of last year, Medvedev, and he did it twice this tournament. I think the resilience is coming back. So physically strong. Like that was a 67-minute first set that Sinner won. And exactly as you said, it just felt like Medvedev was like, okay, well, do that again if you're going to try and beat me. And Sinner couldn't. And Sinner, I think, was was physically a little bit weary towards the end of that match, whereas Medvedev looked really, really strong to me. So I guess my assessment is that this does feel different to Vienna last year, and I hope so, because I really want Medvedev to be back to his best. And I think another sign, sorry, as well, that this is a bit different is he got his first top 10 win in like 12 or 13 months when he beat Auger Aliassime. Like, there were just a lot of good signs that Medvedev is coming back to his best.
Very sweet speech, wasn't there, from Medvedev in Rotterdam about how he hoped his four-month-old daughter would be watching him and enjoying it, and how his wife had told him that she had smiled. She'd been reported to have smiled whilst seeing her dad on TV. Look, I don't know enough about babies' developments to be able to confirm or deny whether that is possible, but it's a very sweet thought.
And something I love that they do during the ceremony in Rotterdam, it's a very sort of modern take on a sort of engraving a trophy. You know how they've got all the names of the previous champions sort of around the court in Rotterdam? I think it's a really cool tradition. Like, you know, you're playing and you can see all the great names, and they sort of added Medvedev's name to that ring of champions during the ceremony. I thought it was a really nice touch. Great. It always feels like Rotterdam really gets those little touches just right, I think.
Yeah, you can see that all around, can't you? I mean, what is it, 50 years of the tournament now? And I was noticing even before the final, I had the stream up sort of 10 minutes before the actual players came out, and the show they put on, the singers they have, the music, there's such a lot of thought and care and attention goes into that tournament.
Yeah, he's off to play in Doha this week, is Medvedev, which I've been keeping an eye on a few players this time of year and seeing how, just been slightly concerned about how much tennis they're playing, but that doesn't concern me so much for Medvedev, because he's been playing less because he's been winning less. Like, I mean, okay, he's not really had an off season, has he? That concerns me a bit, but he did look mentally fresher this week. So maybe he's at that stage in the balance where actually he needs to keep playing and keep up the momentum. If he feels like he's got enough in the tank. Does Jannik Sinner need to get in a lift with David Law and ask why do I lose all the close matches only for David to offer him absolutely no wisdom whatsoever?
And yet turn him into one of the greatest of all time.
Yeah, and claim credit for 100% the 20 grand
success rate so far. I'm quite interested to know what you think about that point, and also one other. First of all, I personally, I'm not worried about Jannik Sinner in that regard. I think he's going to get a win over one of these guys. I think he's getting closer. I think he's got the perfect coach for him, for his development, for him to take. You know, some players are really, really good players, but I question if they don't make a change whether they're ever going to make the next step. And I think that Sinner has got the perfect coach to help him make the next step. And the other one is on the question of, isn't the question more something you've been asking earlier in the week, Catherine, about playing too much, about the sheer amount of tournaments that Jannik Sinner's playing? Holger Rune, I remember when we were in Australia, somebody detailed his planned schedule for the next couple of months, and it's just every week. I mean, I'm so on the fence about this, didn't he, with
an injury that I think he sustained in Melbourne, didn't he? We saw him fall over in Melbourne and injure his wrist, and that's what caused him to retire this week in Rotterdam as well. And I'd looked at that planned schedule and I thought, that's an awful lot of tennis. And I don't know. I know there's a balance. I know that he genuinely just loves playing tennis, and he's at that stage of his career where he just wants to play and see, you know, discovering his powers, see how high he can fly. It must be an irresistible feeling when it all feels like it's upside. But equally, I'm conscious that, and look, I this is based on no specific knowledge of him whatsoever, other than sort of general knowledge of how tennis works, this will be the first season that he's been offered appearance fees for playing these sorts of levels of tournament. You know, anything below 1,000 and Holger Rune will be getting appearance fees. And that's, you know, he'll have never had that before. That they're generally a lot of money, and it must feel like, oh my goodness, I get to play tennis, and regardless of how I do, someone's giving me a hefty check just to be there. I mean, you know, who of us could genuinely say, well, you know, we'd be turning all of that down? So I'm not saying that is the primary motivation, or I don't know how big a motivation it is for Holger Rune or for any other player in his situation. Jannik Sinner will probably be getting appearance fees as well, although I would guess slightly less than Rune is getting just at the moment. But I'm conscious that it's there. And it is part of the picture.
And they're supporting the tour as well. I mean, it's something that we've often listened to Billie Jean King and Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova say. And obviously they had a heck of a lot more at stake in terms of supporting a tour than these guys do. And I don't really think that it's necessarily what goes through Jannik Sinner and Holger Rune's mind. I need to support the tour. But there is an offshoot benefit to the fact that they are playing. And these are really, really good tournaments, and therefore they're getting good fields as well. So, you know, that's why I feel so torn about it, because I do think that they could be doing their chances of peaking at the big tournaments harm by what they're doing. But there's a plus point to it as well. So I don't really know what's the best thing.
Well, Sinner's off to play in Marseille this week, and if a certain Artur Fies, remember him from, was it last week
a week
we were
ago.
Talking about Artur Fies?
Yep.
If he wins his first round match, then he'll play Jannik Sinner in round two. And as much as I've just been sort of discouraging Jannik Sinner from playing tournaments like Marseille, big yes, please to that one. I hope it happens. So thank you, Jannik Sinner, for playing. He and Hubert Hurkacz are the top seeds in Marseille this week. Let's head south now, folks. Let's fly south for the winter to Buenos Aires and a tournament that was won by Carlos Alcaraz. He is back, folks. Beat Cameron Norrie 6-3, 7-5 in the final. Not only is Carlos Alcaraz back, but the Alcarazmataz WhatsApp group is back with a bang. David Law was the hype dampener on that WhatsApp group this week. How does that very, very new role feel to you, David?
Weird. But I feel like, and because I couldn't have been more excited about the tennis that Carlos Alcaraz played last week. I watched all of his matches. I was jumping around the kitchen while I got it on the iPad while I'm doing the cooking, just because he takes my breath away unlike any other player in terms of what he's able to do. And frankly, the frequency with which he does it, because he's always looking to do it on his backhand and forehand. And with his movement, everything feels explosive and spectacular and exciting and breathtaking. And it was all there. I mean, okay, I think maybe one or two of the matches actually I watched on highlights. Therefore, I'm only seeing the good bits. And I did
quite long
the
highlights, though, weren't they?
Yeah, I did note the commentators saying, you know, there's an element of some of his play that is erratic and he's missing some as well, which, you know, of course, when you're taking that degree of risk with your shot making and you're going that hard and that close to the lines, you're going to miss. I think the bigger concern for me second half of last year, the main thing is injuries, obviously, but there was a period from the French Open for a couple of months where it was like he would suddenly lose his game, lose his ability to be consistent and get these balls in. Well, I watched all the final last night against Cameron Norrie, a good player, you know, and I just thought the guy is able to harness and control this power at the moment, and it was amazing.
Yeah, I think when we're thinking about scheduling as well, like, to me, this feels like quite smart scheduling from Alcaraz to like make his comeback here. It feels like he's really, you know, already got that winning feeling back. You know, it was a draw that he felt like he should win and did win. And in that final against Norrie, like, I've seen Norrie play a lot of tennis matches, and, you know, there are players who have much bigger games than Norrie and yet still find it really hard to put him away and beat him. It's always pretty much a grind against Norrie. And I know that he managed to make that second set close in the end, but there was a middle portion of that match where Alcaraz was just cutting through Norrie, kind of like you don't see that many players do at all. And, you know, for him to finish it on that sort of signature shot of the forehand drop shot, I thought was like a nice sort of, yep, Carlos Alcaraz is back moment as well. And yeah, just the whole thing was like really, really impressive from Alcaraz.
I just loved it. I just love watching him play like that. I know it's 250. I know it's on clay and he's going to have to switch to hard courts, and who knows whether he'll be able to carry that form on. Who knows if he'll be able to carry it on into this week where he's playing Rio. And he'll probably have to play Cam Norrie again in the final because they're the top two seeds, and it's just sort of, let's do this again. but I just loved it. It's great to have him back. It is, look, it's awful when anyone suffers with injuries that keeps them on the sidelines, but when it happens just as you reach your highest peak, and when you're so young, and when everything seems so exciting, when you get sort of brought down to earth like that, it's, I mean, obviously more crushing for him, but very selfishly pretty crushing for us as viewers, that we just got used to him just being reliably there and being a part of our week in, week out tennis watching lives, and enriching them so much that, you know, this time last year, taking Carlos Alcaraz out of the picture, we'd have missed him, but it wouldn't have been a cavern escaping hole. But it has felt like that a bit. We really missed him at the Australian Open, didn't we? And it's incredibly great to have him back.
Yeah, it is. And can I tell you who else doesn't know whether Alcaraz is going to be able to sustain this? Because off the back of Alcaraz-Mataz discussions and, you know, the phrase French Open was being bandied about a lot in that chat, and, you know, conversation turned whether he could win it. I was having a play around yesterday with ChatGPT, and I asked ChatGPT, can Carlos Alcaraz win the 2023 French Open? And I must say, it's quite funny that this sort of artificial intelligence language bot that seems to be really sort of progressive and amazing, I would say it really needs to update its tennis knowledge, because there were some very outdated references when I put in Carlos Alcaraz. It first of all said that he's won 3 ATP titles, including UMAG, and I'm like, I think he's got some bigger career highlights. And and it said he's defeated some of the top players in the world, including Stefanos Tsitsipas and Roberto Bautista Agut, who, you know, is just pleased to be there, really. And in terms of the French Open, it mentioned his third round loss to Jan-Lennard Struff in 2021. But then it said, of course, he will be up against tough competition from other players, but if he can stay healthy and continue to progress, he could definitely be in the mix for the title.
Hey.
You've done ChatGPT a favour there, Matt, by your annoying, vague phrasing of the question. Of course he can win the French Open. He could have won last year's French Open. Punch. He just didn't. That's very David Law of you. And
can I ask one very important question on probably quite a few of our listeners' behalf? What is
Everyone knows what ChatGPT. My mum's using ChatGPT, David.
No, they don't. I've never used it until you mentioned it in passing a couple of days ago. I'd never heard of it. What is it?
It's machine learning software that's freely available and has just dropped and has changed all of our lives without us realizing it. Right. It can approximate with varying degrees of accuracy. For example, I asked ChatGPT to write an article in the style of Simon Briggs, and it did quite a good job.
Okay, that is quite worthwhile. That's very funny.
I also asked, who can stop Świątek? And it gave me a very sad list of players saying, some players who have a good chance of stopping Świątek on any given day include other top-ranked players like Ash Barty, Naomi Osaka, Simona Halep, and Aryna Sabalenka, among others. And look, there are some problems with three of those for very different reasons.
So it's a comedian.
Look, tennis is hard to keep up with, David, even for a very intelligent bit of machine
learning. Need to listen to the tennis podcast.
Maybe it will. So Carlos Alcaraz goes on to Rio. Just tell us why you're dampening the hype a little bit, David.
Well, I mean, I think on the upside, watching him this week made me remember that as brilliant as he was last year, that was not the finished article. That was teenage version Carlos Alcaraz. And he's going to get better. He's going to become a better match player. He's going to understand the sport more. He's got so much further to go. The worry is the physicality. The worry is his body just breaking down. It broke down a few times. And I mean, he gave a very interesting interview, I thought, on the court after winning that title in Buenos Aires, where he said he kind of alluded to having done the wrong thing during the layoff.
He apologized, didn't he?
Yeah, he said, I feel guilty. I feel guilty that I was off during this period of time from the tour. And kind of it was my fault is the gist of it. And look, we don't know whether his body can stand what he's putting it through. Now, the same conversations were had 20 years ago about Andy Roddick with his serve. How can a shoulder cope with what Andy Roddick is doing to it? Well, it did cope for the vast majority of his career. People said the same about Rafael Nadal. How can those knees and the rest of his physique stand up to what he's putting it through? Well, here he is, 20 years on, and he's still going. So I'm hopeful, but it's a long, long way until the French Open. And I still, look, I think Carlos Alcaraz is top level. It's different to Novak Djokovic, but it's just as devastating, arguably more, because he doesn't rely on you doing something. He just takes it from you. But a lot could go wrong.
He's Math in our Alcaraz Mataz group chat this week put his finger on why Alcaraz is so important, I think, to men's tennis and important as a potential rival to Novak Djokovic, because he can do something against Djokovic that nobody else now can do, which is the Wawrinkian thing of being able to hit winners from several meters behind the baseline, not just hang in points from several meters by the baseline, but have the strength to hit winners from back there. So the sort of the Djokovic tactic of just pushing you further and further back, it's less effective. And that, you know, seeing that sort of Superman versus Kryptonite dynamic is, I just want to see it. I want to see it over and over again. I want to see them try and figure one another out. And it was incredible, David. It was absolutely incredible.
And the thing is, he's also got the speed to go toe-to-toe, side-to-side, to get back in rallies the way Djokovic can, but then take over with an acceleration and injection of power that I don't think even Djokovic has. And then he's got the soft-as-butter drop shot, which is just, oh, what a combination. If he can figure out his game well enough and stay fit. Oh, my word.
And we saw Alcaraz Djokovic in Madrid, and it was incredible, but Madrid is an outlier of a tournament in that clay court swing, you know, because of the altitude. It generally doesn't normally sort of forecast that well for Roland Garros. You know, Rome tends to be the one where people say conditions are a lot more similar. And yeah, I mean, I think David was only dampening hype in terms of whether he might win the French Open. Like, I still think, you know, the fact we're even talking about that is a lot of hype.
Yeah, I mean, Math was watching it saying, well, just close the competition now. Like, nobody
give him
can
the trophy now.
And yeah, it did.
Which is what I was saying a year ago.
The sort of tennis, it looked like nobody could beat it. Of course it did. But, you know, Novak Djokovic makes people unable to play their top level. B, Rafael Nadal has won 14.
Oh, yeah. Don't
care how injured he is. He's won 14 of them. And C, it's a lot to sustain. And he's, you know, been a question mark since he won the US Open. So I logically understand all the reasons not to be on board the hype train, but also toot toot. Let's Party Like It's 2008 news, Simone Bellelli and Fabio Fognini won the doubles title in Buenos Aires. Maybe 2008 is a bit harsh, but definitely the past. That feels like a result from the past.
Yeah, that's going back a bit.
Well done to them. Heading now to Delray Beach, a tournament that I've been to many a time because it used to feature on the ATP Champions Tour. The ATP and the Champions Tour event would run in tandem over the opening weekend of the tournament, and a truly delightful place to visit. I used to love my little trips to Delray Beach. Won this year by Taylor Fritz. He beat Miomir Kecmanovic 6-love, 5-7, 6-2 in the final. It's a title that will propel Taylor Fritz inside the world's top five. Does that feel right to you? Taylor Fritz, top five player. How does that sound? Like,
I think it's about right.
Is he in your mind a top five player?
Yeah, and actually I think his Grand Slam performances have been really disappointing the last two, and I think he would agree with that. I think losing as you did to, it was
Brandon Holt in New York.
Brandon Holt. Sorry, Tracy. Brandon Holt.
Jordan Holt won our predictions competition last year.
Right, Jordan.
He's going to be thrilled with that shout out.
Yeah, he's got a mention out of the blue. and
really up the ante on the shout out front there, David.
And the sensation in Australia who defeated him,
Alexi by the name Popperin.
Of Alexi Popperin. Yeah. I've had a bit of a flare for the old long COVID folks in this 24 hours. It is extraordinary what Fritz has done on the tour, but those were two really disappointing Grand Slam results when I had him going deep, and he had himself going deep as well. But generally speaking, I think of him now as a top player and somebody who needs to now reproduce it. I mean, and winning Delray Beach is exactly what he should be doing, and he did it. So good for him. I think he'll do well at some of the Masters 1000 between now and the French, but he should be doing well at all the, he should be comfortably second week, deep into the second week of all the Grand Slams with his game.
Yeah, like, I think there are at least five players whose top level is higher than Taylor Fritz, and if that's how rankings were done, then Taylor Fritz wouldn't probably be in my top five, but given the way the rankings are done, he's become incredibly consistent on tour. And he's also done this a lot recently, which is win titles. Like, I think he used to have a really bad record in finals, but he's turned it around in the last year or so, obviously starting in Indian Wells last year. And he's sort of carried that on, just picking up titles just pretty regularly as the season's gone on. And that's to his immense credit. And it's just all about the slams now for him, isn't it? And trying to push, you know, go deep in a slam and certainly avoid these really early exits.
Yeah, he's got such a different problem to Jannik Sinner, doesn't he? I mean, I definitely don't think of him as somebody that loses the close matches. I really trust him in the tight spots. He's got this great tiebreak record, this even better deciding set tiebreak record, doesn't he? You know, he's I suppose we can use the term because he is American, he's clutch, isn't he, Taylor Fritz? I hated how that sounded coming out of my mouth. I regretted it instantly. I take it back. But the point is made. That's definitely not the issue for Taylor Fritz. It's sort of just not showing up, weirdly. I suppose he showed up against Brandon Holt, didn't he? Yeah, that's too simplistic to say not showing up, but I don't know. Yeah, things to prove at Grand Slam. We haven't. It's a good title. Well done, Taylor Fritz. Being a top five player is a big deal. We didn't learn anything about him this week, I think is what I'm getting at. The doubles title in Delray was won by Marcelo Arevalo and Jean-Julien Roger. They beat Rhys Stolder and Rinki Hijikata in the final. Hey. David, your favourite.
Half a sensation.
Half a sensation.
He's a very much a... He's a fully fledged sensation in my eyes.
No, I mean the doubles team as a whole was okay. Half a sensation. Missing right. A key Jason Kubler ingredient to win the title.
Yeah, that's what would have got him over the line.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare tri-term medical plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
One other little story for you from Delray Beach, which I really like, and it's come to us via the Delray Beach media director, Tony Woods, who got in touch with us to alert us to Mattia Petsetic, ranked 784 in the world. He qualified for his first ever ATP main draw at the Delray Beach Open at the age of 33. He's a former All-American at Princeton. He was three times named the Ivy League Player of the Year. He would later use time during an extended illness to attend Harvard Business School. So after graduating, he set a goal to play full-time for 12 months to get into the top 250. And if he didn't make it, he would give up on tennis. And after 6 months, he was on track, ranked about 320 in the world. But then, and I don't know if anybody remembers this, but a pandemic hit. Billie Jean, shush. And the tour was shut down. So at this stage, he's a 10-time winner on the ITF circuit, and he decided to call it a day, call it a career, went to work full time at a Palm Beach real estate investment company, still hitting balls before work, sometimes with his 70-year-old boss, and running after work to stay in shape just in case an opportunity comes up. That's what I'm thinking when I go on the Peloton. I'll stay in shape just in case the phone rings. You never know. You never know how desperate the Billie Jean King Cup team will be. but lo and behold, one came last month when he was a member of the Croatian team United Cup in Australia. He grew up in Malta, but his parents are Croatian. Then he happened to be on site at the Delray Beach tournament picking up rackets from the stringer when he got into the qualifying draw as an alternate 30 minutes before a match. So in that first qualifying match, he was leading Stefan Kozlov 7-6, 5-all when Kozlov retired. In his second and final qualifying match, he came back to beat Tennis Sangren 3-6, 6-3, 6-2. And that put him into his first ever ATP main draw, for which he had to leave work early to play his match at 6 p.m, which he won. He defeated 2017 Delray champion and former world number 8 Jack Sock for a first tour level win. And he went to work the next day. Tony says that he sent us a video to show us, and we were talking to him in between his meetings. And that evening, he played his next round match, lost out 6-3, 6-3 to Marcus Giron. He was working with, here's a random one. Tony says, Dominic Habati is a longtime friend of his boss, which presumably is the aforementioned 70-year-old with whom Mattia sometimes hits before work. And Dominic Habati was coaching him for the week. He says he's keeping his day job for now, but is open to any wild cards that might come his way. It's a real sort of gives you hope story, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an interesting one as well, because he is in a really big time job. I mean, I was reading up about the job he's got. You know, he's I think making a fortune. He doesn't need to worry about anything. But if he was going, but he's got this dream. He loves the sport. He desperately wishes he kind of had made it, I think, and managed to make it work, not had the injuries, obviously running into the pandemic and it derailing his chance at maybe getting back on the road. And what do you do? Do you decide to give it up? I mean, I saw Novak Djokovic messaged him on Instagram, you know, that it's like the tour is out there, but it's so uncertain, the tennis tour. And he's got this great job and he's 33. What do you do? Do you go for it or do you not? He hasn't got the miles on the clock that the article was saying. So, you know, he feels fresh, but it's a really interesting story to follow.
I read that he hit with Djokovic before one of Djokovic's US Open finals against Nadal, because he's a lefty and he was sort of chosen as the hitting partner. You know, he played the role of, you know, trying to replicate Nadal ahead of a US Open final that Novak Djokovic was playing against him. Yeah, it's an amazing story. And I believe he's the second oldest player to win their first ATP match sort of since those records started being kept, which was about 1990. Yeah, he's the second oldest. So just absolutely remarkable.
Go for it. I know it's very easy for me to say, but my advice would be go for it. It sounds like financially he's okay. I mean, if it was a financial sort of livelihood risk for him, I'd say, you know, fair enough. Just, you know. But if he's financially okay, why wouldn't you go for it? Real estate's not going to go anywhere. It's always going to be jobs in real estate in Florida. Go for it, mate. I think it's a really cool story, and I want to be able to follow more of it. So what about this week then? I've touched upon a few bits and bobs already. Andreescu just lost to Elena Rybakina. It doesn't look brilliant for Bianca Andreescu at the moment. She did have a break in that second set, but it was a bit limp in the end from her, suffering from that neck shoulder injury. Swiatek's got Leila Fernandez in her opener. We've already seen, is this right, Matt? We've already seen the two longest matches of the year, and they've both sort of been in the last 24 hours.
Yes. Yesterday we had Samsonova coming from a set down, I think, to beat Belosa. And that was the longest match of the year at the time. And then today we had Sorana Castella beating Beatrice Haddad-Meyer in 3 hours, 30 minutes. And that is the new longest match of the year.
Samsonova now plays Zhong Xin Wen, which is an interesting one. Arina Sabalenka returns this week, and we have Efrovitova, Linda, going well. She's already beaten Danielle Collins in round one, so tough couple of weeks for Danielle Collins. Very interesting to see how Arina Sabalenka comes out, isn't it? You know, is there any kind of letdown? Has she sort of had sufficient time to process what she did in Australia? Remember that French Open, the Wimbledon after Simona Halep's French Open win, where she was just too happy. She was just kind of not there emotionally because she hadn't had the time to process it. You know, French Open comes around far too quickly on the heels of French Open. Did I say French Open twice there? Wimbledon, French Open. You know what I mean, folks. there is a WTA event in Mexico this week in Merida as well. 250 event. Magda Linette and Sloane Stephens are the top two seeds. Zhu Lin and Alicia Parks are also in the draw there. They're two of our ones to watch that we've picked out from the last few weeks, aren't they? We talked about ATP event in Rio. Dominic Thiem is also in the field there, along with Carlos Alcaraz and Cam Norrie. It's grim viewing, Dominic Thiem, at the moment, isn't it? I've been the most hopeful of all of us over the last few weeks and months, I think. Sort of, I've been feeding off what we saw in Vienna at the back end of last year, but I increasingly fear that was the anomaly. And it, very worryingly, we've gone from sort of extremely slow progress with Dominic Thiem to potentially backwards movement. It's really tough to watch him at the moment.
Yeah, I was quite shocked, actually. I saw him play against the Peruvian player last week who had such a good run, whose name escapes me at the moment, but who was excellent and who followed it up with a good win over... That's the one against Lorenzo Musetti. Beat him as well. It was a really, really good week for him. But I don't know. I don't know what I'm expecting from Dominic Thiem, but I found it a tough watch. He doesn't look like he knows. He was just relentlessly slicing his backhand to try to keep it in, it seemed. And I thought, God, this is a tough one. You know, and I kind of consoled myself by going and watching the 10 moments when he's upset the big three in a rally. Oh. You know, and there's like this compilation video. And I just went and watched that and just...
Did that cheer you up or did that make...
I was going to say, did you feel consoled after watching that? Did that
emphasize how sad it is? It kind of achieved both. It kind of made me feel upbeat, like excited, because it's just such a wonderful video. And it's a bit like watching Alcaraz, you know, in that kind of breathtaking way. But then, yeah, there is the reminder, the grim reminder that Dominic Thiem is not that player anymore. And I'm not sure. In fact, I don't think he will ever become that again. And that's really hard to think about.
I'm starting to agree with you. And that's really tough. That hurts to say.
And I hope I'm wrong. I just hope he proves me wrong.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Also from this week, Novak Djokovic today is starting his 377th week as the world number one, and that equals the record of Steffi Graf. So next week he will become the solo record holder for men's and women's tennis since the rankings started, which is incredible. And I know it's a record that really matters to him, and it should matter. You know, it's significant, and I know it won't be talked about. It's one of those underrated records, I think, in tennis. Probably should be talked about as much as the number of slams, Olympic gold medals, all of that. You know, I always think Rafael Nadal's record of consecutive weeks inside the world's top 10, which I know is about to come to an end, but that is an underrated record in tennis. Well, this one is just 377 weeks, and to have done it, we've had the debate before, haven't we? What's more impressive, the doing it consecutively and staying there, or being knocked off the top and continually coming back. But he's had periods where he's done both. And it's an incredible record.
Yeah, unreal. And it is quite different to Steffi Graf's in that sense. Steffi Graf's was 377 in a much, much shorter time frame, whereas Novak Djokovic's is, what, over 12 years? And I think, we'll, you know, he's 377 and counting, isn't it? Because, you know, you would be pretty sure that he might even get to somewhere like 400, you know, or more even, the way he's going. And yeah, it's just another example of his longevity being something which generally isn't recognized as much. I realize that we say that a lot, and therefore we are probably recognizing his longevity, but just generally compared to Federer and Serena and Nadal, because he wasn't the first, we do maybe take it for granted a bit. But yeah, he's won 10 slams in his 30s. He's had over 100 weeks at number one in his 30s. And yeah, there's just no letting up. It's amazing.
And that's it for your news from the week that was in tennis. I don't know why I said that so wistfully. This week will be good too. But we do need to get the show off the road, because Billie Jean has just broken into a bag of Lily's Kitchen beef and turkey food, dried food. So if you can hear munching in the background, that is what's going on. we do still have time, I think. Slow down, Billie Jean. Time to tell you that our mascot this week for this episode is Simona Halep the cat. Natalie Price tells us, Simona is a beautiful white and grey ragdoll cat, 18 months old, born in Headley, Surrey. Her mother belongs to my best friend from school, also called Catherine, same church, same pew. Simona has a twin brother called Rafa Nadal and a canine brother called Boris. Who's Boris named after? You've got Rafael Nadal, Simona Halep, and... Right, yes. Yes. But why not both names? You've got Simona Halep, Rafael Nadal, and just, you know, it's like Prince, I mean, I suppose.
I'm only guessing, but, you know.
Mm. Well, anyway, she's beautiful. Ragdoll cats are gorgeous. They totally live up to their name. You can just sort of... You pick them up and they literally just... Every muscle in their body flops and they just go limp in your arms and like, okay, let's cuddle now. Yeah, they're lovely. And Simona is lovely. She's looking at me right now. She's standing underneath an orchid and it's all just loveliness. So thank you, Simona. And thank you, Natalie. We have our mascots. David has Maisie. I have Xenia and Matt has Darwin. Billie Amazing. Jean, the ravenous Billie Jean, is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. Our top folks and executive producers are Jamie, Hannah and Drew. Hello to them. And we have shout outs, or rather more shout outs, because we've already had Jordan Holt being awarded a first round win at the US Open last year. Who else have we got, Matt?
Big win.
We have got Lauren McLean, who is in Edinburgh.
Hello, Lauren.
Hello, Lauren.
I once covered
like
a
Lauren Davis
Champions Tour event in Edinburgh as well. Not a hugely successful event, but a lovely city.
Nope.
That was the one
was
where
the one
they
rained with a roof.
They splashed out on a roof because, you know, it's Scotland and it was an outdoor event, but the roof wasn't big enough for the tennis court.
No.
It was a problem. Rained all weekend. Anyway, lovely city. Thank you, Lauren.
We've also got Reggie.
No. Is it not, is not it the Reggie?
Well, listen, the shout out has put Reggie and I'm taking it as the Reggie.
And, wow.
And I have new information about Reggie, courtesy of this shout out. Reggie says, I was a ball boy at Wimbledon a few years ago, but didn't go back for a second year because I wanted to spend more time watching the tennis. The podcast was the only way I managed to keep up with what was going on that year.
Well, that profile fits, doesn't it? Age it and does. Geography wise for the yeah. Reggie.
Yeah. Wow. And honestly, I feel you, Reggie. I used to never apply for a job at Wimbledon because I didn't want to be working in the catering. I wanted to be watching the tennis. So I feel like I'm on a level with Reggie. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's a great thing. We love Reggie.
It's a great thing. We love Reggie. Hello, Reggie. We're not even going to bother naming other tennis Reggies because A, we can't, and B, you're the only one, Reggie. One of a kind. This is a tough act to follow, isn't it? Who's our third and final shout out?
Well, our final shout out comes from Aditya Joshi. And Aditya says, I've been a friend of the podcast for the past year now, but I haven't found the right occasion to give my shout out. However, recently my grandfather passed away and I felt there was no better time. I've watched and loved tennis for the past 15 years now, and I owe a large part of that to him. Some of my fondest memories were staying up late into the night watching Wimbledon on our small TV in our apartment in Mumbai. But none of that mattered because we created a joyous atmosphere amongst each other's company as we tried to see who could take down Roger Federer or Serena Williams. So shout out to my grandfather, Mardav, a huge tennis fan and an even bigger sports fan.
Oh, that's lovely.
Aditya, that is lovely and very, very moving and a gorgeous tribute to your grandfather. So I'm sorry for your loss, but sounds like quite a man, and he got you into tennis, so that's a life well lived, I reckon. So thank you for supporting the podcast and for that lovely tribute. That's a really lovely way to end the pod. Billie Jean has returned full belly, don't have to give her dinner now. Great, she's feeding herself, self-sufficient dog. Brilliant. It's like a protest at the level of care she's getting, as if my whole day doesn't revolve around her. Absurd.
I'll just sort anyway, myself out, shall I?
That is, but she looked at me, whined. She whined right the way through our piece about what's his chops, winning his first match in Delray Beach, and then just went, all right, I'll help myself then.
Oh, she's doing that podcast thing.
Right, I'm going to go see if I can tempt her with some organic chicken, see if she'll deign to eat that. It's been a pleasure, folks. Always a pleasure. Can't wait to do it again next week. And in 2 weeks' time, we will all be on a plane to Indian Wells. We all, and David's golf clubs, and Matt's golf clubs also, I think.
Yes, if we can, absolutely.
We can make the booking.
I need to get myself down to the range so I'm not embarrassed.
2 weeks and counting, folks. We'll be there, thanks to On Location. We can't wait. And we'll be back next week to round up all the events that we've just told you about that are happening and to further look forward to Indian Wells. We'll speak to you then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.